Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Carolyn. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and my co-host, Carolyn Kilbourne.
Good afternoon, everyone. Beautiful day. Love this weather. This is one of those 5 days in Iowa that's perfect.
I think if we kept track, we'd end up with more than five.
I know. I just like to do that.
So
I'm a native Iowan, so, you know.
Today's August 31st, so we could be having really miserable weather.
True.
Yeah. So if you're listening live on Friday, it's August 31st, and welcome to the show. And if you're listening to our rebroadcast, then it's probably Monday morning, and off to a great start for the week.
Mm-hmm.
We have a really special guest today, somebody who has done a lot to further the cause of writing and publishing and authors in our community and beyond, way beyond our community.
We have a plethora of books here to talk about, and it's going to be great.
So please welcome Rodney Charles. Hi, Rodney.
Good morning, ladies, or afternoon, rather.
Yeah, barely.
Now, Rodney, according to his bio on the web, is an entrepreneur and business leader who conceived the First World Library Literary Society mission while acting as president and managing editor of his own self-built book publishing companies, Sunstar Publishing and First World Library. And he's also authored four books, including one that he's going to read a selection from today, which is Every Day a Miracle Happens. And so you, Rodney, have a very broad experience in the publishing world, don't you?
Well, I haven't looked at it in a while, but it's sounding good when I hear it read back to me.
Well, I would say with the variety of books that you brought here for us to look at, I would say that, you know, it's marvelous. For instance, The Warren Method of Dog Training, Using Love, Trust, and Respect, Stay, Come, Heal Every Time. It sounds really interesting, and a lot of people would be interested in that, I'm sure.
So, Rodney, maybe you can kind of tell us, put into categories the different things that you do, you know, the publishing versus the First World website, and tell us, just give us a little brief overview of your various activities.
Okay, well, first and foremost, I regard myself a writer. It seems that my activities these days are more business-like, which is also equally fun, I have to admit. So I'm blessed in that I get to do what I really, really like to do, and for that reason I feel like I'm riding on inspiration just about all day long, which is a great way to live your life, in my opinion. There are different divisions, okay? There's the writing side of me, and that usually takes place early in the morning or late at night. Then there's the business side of me there. We have a nonprofit organization, and that organization, its goals are to maintain a free internet library. People can come and download all the old classics, and we've published, it's hard to keep up with the count because it changes every month. I think we're at somewhere in the neighborhood of 7,200 titles at this point and continuing to grow. And we're trying to grow at a rate of about 300 books per month, but it's more than we can swallow.
Wow.
So it's a question of just manpower and whatever else that we can do.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a rather ambitious rate, and we're trying to maintain that. We're very close to it now, and it may take us just several more months to actually get up to that marker. So again, as I said, we've published anything you've ever gone through school on, from, you know, Shakespeare to Freud to Einstein to Mark Twain to almost anything you know.
Now, these
are
all books that are in the public domain?
These are all public domain books,
yes. And what exactly does that mean?
It means that we all own the copyright on them.
And that's because they're old, like copyrights only.
They're copyright. They're copyright free at this point. It's expired because of hundreds of years after the deaths of many of the authors, or in many cases, they were just simply put in the public domain immediately by the author's decree.
Now, what is the normal length of copyright?
Oh boy, there's a tricky question. Congress is changing that every day. But
really?
As a general rule, if it goes past 62 years or even 67, that's one of those debatable areas, it's probably in the public domain. Congress has allowed for another 20-year continuation of the copyright, and I believe there's another one in the process in this country. So it's a bit of a gray area, and there's all kinds of paperwork that has to be done to either to find out if you can acquire a copyright to publish, or if you can maintain a copyright that you think your family may have owned. So it's an area of the law that I try to stay away from because I find it a little too difficult.
So you basically go with things that you know are copyrighted.
Right. We stay with the tried and true area, and we use Carnegie Mellon as our host here. That we, if they've cleared it, then it's good enough for us.
Now, would you venture a guess as to how many books there are in the public domain?
Well, it depends on how many languages you want to look at.
Okay, let's look at English at the moment.
I had an interesting discussion with the fellow who started the Gutenberg Library, and between the two of us and a few others, we came up with this very interesting number. And I think it was just at the end of two or three days of laboring the conversation that we decided there are 1 million intelligent books in the public domain written in English. And everything after that really doesn't have much value other than perhaps historical, some marginal historical value. So that's what we're looking at, approximately 1 million titles.
So does that mean that's what you're trying to publish on the internet is 1 million titles?
That in an ideal world, that would be wonderful. Wow. I'm not sure how long I'll be around, but at the present rate, I don't think we'll make 1 million. According to the Library of Congress, there are approximately 10,000 books that are checked out on relative to everything else. After that, we're looking at let's say 98% of the population checks out 10,000 books. After that, we're looking at deeply scholarly or esoteric texts that are probably only used by the rare few late night scholars and deep thinkers who just have to have that little tidbit of knowledge.
Wow!
So 10,000 books would probably be sufficient for us.
So if you get 10,000, you'll have what 98% of people
That's
are
right.
looking for.
That's
and,
right.
And you're close to that.
Well, we're getting close. We still feel that we have a ways to go, but the longer you do this, the stranger it becomes, quite honestly, because you think, wow, that's every title I've ever heard of in my whole life, and then you start, wait, I've heard of that one, and it just keeps going on and on.
Well, how do you decide which ones to put on?
Well, you're asking all the fun questions. The part of this is we try to decide on what's going to be most popular, and there's various places that we can go to find out, and one of them, of course, is the Library of Congress. And the simple method is what gets checked out the most. Well, the number one, believe it or not, the number one most checked out book out of the Library of Congress in the field of the classics, that is William Shakespeare. So we can just sort of go down the list that the Library of Congress has provided and see if we can get those. But getting the titles is another matter. That's, again, a whole other level of complication, trying to find them through various digital sources. Do we have to OCR them? Do we have to actually key them in manually ourselves? So rule of thumb is that we take what is most easily available at this point, and if we have a demand from various people, because there's a huge market for these books, it turns out that we've created a book that teachers really like because they're big. And I don't know if you noticed, but the fonts, we decided to go with a slightly larger than average font so that it'd be easier. And I think that was just my own unique idiosyncrasy here, that my eyes are starting to fail me, and I thought, I can't read this.
I think you're
Make
right.
Make the font bigger.
Yeah, I think you're right.
So teachers seem to love them. It turns out academics are all wearing reading glasses of one kind or another, so the bigger font appealed to them. And then as it turns out, the students like them because they all look like Macintosh colors. And between the two, we've gained this huge market in the educational industry now, so that we're actually moving a lot of books out to libraries.
Now,
and
you're publishing
school.
These on the Internet,
mm-hmm.
But I've got physical books in my hand. So how do they get from there? And do all 7,200 titles come in physical form?
Yes. Book
form?
Yeah. We publish them as e-books, which we give away freely. And most of those are downloaded outside of the United States in developing countries. Americans being the ultimate consumers in the world, you're not satisfied to have just an e-book. They have to have both. So they once they've used up the ebook for their assignment. It's usually students, I think, who are downloading these. Then I liked that book. I better buy it. So they go out and buy either the soft cover or the hard cover, and we make them both available. Then there's a book sale that helps the nonprofit generate more books for
now,
the library.
How do you make 7,200 different titles available in hardcover and softcover? That wouldn't have been possible 5 years ago, would it?
Oh, no. You're right. It absolutely wouldn't have been. We're pretty cutting edge as far as all publishing elements go, and I have strong opinions about where the publishing industry is going, but then I've really been fighting and hard to make it go in that direction. The book that you're looking at right now, a book by George Orwell, looks like it's probably about 350 pages. This book, in its soft cover form, can be printed almost exactly as you see it, full color, laminated, in about, I'd say, a minute and a half to 2 minutes maximum.
Oh, my God.
Fully color, laminated cover the whole bit. So we're making use of the print-on-demand technology, and the titles are all ready to print. All of our books are ready to print. They're loaded in a mainframe computer. A signal comes in. We don't even have to know about it. A signal comes in from wherever, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, the education system. It really doesn't matter where that order comes from. It just gets stacked in a line in any combination. It could be, 10 copies of George Orwell, 5 copies of Thomas Jefferson, 15 copies of Mark Twain, 1 copy of William Shakespeare, and it will print them in exactly that order. Even if the next one on the line is just a single copy of George Orwell again, it'll just continue to print them like that, one after another.
Wow.
So for every minute or so that ticks by, probably at least one book will have been produced.
And it's printed and bound and...
Printed, bound, ready to go. It's literally hot off the press. It still feels warm. The only person that actually touches it, there are no people involved in this process, just some big fat guy who sits around a giant horseshoe wall of computers making sure that none of the presses lock up. And if they do, he just sort of pulls that title out and puts it back on the top, and it starts all over again. The only person who touches it from the time, say you order the book on Amazon right now, you just say, I want a copy of Animal Farm by George Orwell. You pay Amazon for the book. They take your money. The signal goes to the mainframe. The printer turns on. The book gets printed off. No one has touched that book yet. It goes onto a conveyor belt. Somebody looks up at a TV screen and says, oh, I have to ship this book to Monica in Fairfield, puts it in an envelope, seals it, puts the postage on, and it ends up in your doorstep.
So that's the only time it's physically touched is when it's mailed.
Yeah, pretty much. Now that's pretty cutting edge.
Yeah.
That's pretty cutting edge. And I'd like to see the whole publishing industry move in this direction.
I was just going to ask you, is this common, is print on demand or not?
It's not as common as it ought to be, but it's becoming. People are simply waking up. It's kind of a no-brainer for publishers.
Yeah.
I used to be a publisher of the old method where you printed up anywhere from 2,000 to 10,000 copies of a book for your first print run to get it out there to test the market.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an enormous waste of time, energy, money,
paper,
storage, insurance costs. It goes on and on and on. So for
right.
publishers, it's an absolute no-brainer. You pay more per unit with print on demand, but there's no, you don't have to pay, $40,000 to get a book launched.
And you're not stuck with 10,000 books.
That's right. At the end of it all, if the whole thing is a failure, you don't have to worry about it because you didn't tear down any forests in the process of trying to
and
get a book.
And if it's a success, would you then go and do a 10,000 print run to get the lower per piece copy?
I personally wouldn't, and personally haven't. We've had various programs, and we've published books that have made it to the bestseller list, and we've decided we're not going the old traditional route. It goes against our message. So there have been a few occasions when we've thought maybe we should do this because, and the because is that there's so much pressure being put on us by chain stores and whatnot. Oh, we want all these books. We want them sitting in our warehouses, and we want them all to be returnable and all the rest. So there have been occasions when we thought, should we do this? But to date, we haven't. We haven't had to go that route, and hopefully we'll stick to our guns, and we won't have to go that route. And by not going that route, hopefully the other publishers will figure it out and say, hey, they didn't do it. And they had a bestseller, so why can't we go that route?
So in the old, tell us a little bit about the kind of the logistics and economics of publishing the old way, so we can see the difference. Some listeners might not understand the whole return and, you know, distributor to bookstore to consumer and how the returns work and so forth. It's different than most industries.
All right, I'm trying to think of the easiest way to get into that because it can sound pretty dry. How about this? I'll tell you how I started in the publishing industry because that sort of covers that ground.
What year would this be?
Oh, boy. Don't take me there.
You're listening to
Writers. You still have linear logic.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Carolyn and our guest, Rodney Charles, who is the founder of First World Literary Society and Sunstar Publishing and First World Library.
And here's the story.
And here's the story of how he got started.
The rest of the story.
All right. Now, here's something many people in Fairfield can relate to. When I came here, I was as broke as anybody could possibly be. I spent 14 years on Purusha, so there was no money in the coffers. So the lesson is, how do you make a living? So I thought, well, I'll write a book. That seemed ambitious, and having spent 14 years on Purusha, I thought, well, I love to read about saints, so I got all my materials together and started writing late at night. You know, I had a day job to stay alive, and wrote this book, the one that's somewhere on this table, Every Day a Miracle Happens, and I was so proud of it, as every author should always be of everything they do, and I thought, how am I going to get this published? And I sent out all my letters to prospective publishers and received large quantities of rejection letters. You know, the form-generated rejection letter, which is just double insult anyway. So that didn't work, and I thought, well, you know, there can't be that many stupid publishers in the world. So what will I do? I thought, well, I'll publish it myself. So I thought, okay, that'll be easy. I can probably figure out how to do that. So I did a little research. Got a word processing program, made the whole thing look nice and neat and clean. When I printed it out, printed out the cover, you know, a nice color cover. Well, from a distance, you know, if you squinted and you know, maybe it was a foggy day, the book almost looked like a real book from a distance. So I took that, and it was about a 1,200-page manuscript at that point. But I took it to the local bank, and I said, look at this. You know, this is the greatest book ever written, and, you know, all the things that new authors always say. And I could tell there was some question of doubt in the mind of the loan officer. And he listened very nicely. He was a very pleasant man. And he proceeded to just, okay, well, let's just check your credit history here. Well, you know, having been right off of Purusha, I had no credit history. I'd never had a bank account. I'd never had a credit card.
Oh, my.
So I didn't even appear in their databases. So that was in a bank. That's cause for concern. You know, I must be some sort of criminal. Anyway, they politely laughed me out of the bank, and that was that. And I thought, gee, you know, I can't believe how these people can't see that this particular, you know, book is the salvation for all humanity. What's wrong with these people? So I thought, I'll figure out a way to publish it myself nonetheless. So I went to the local library, and I got listings for all the book retailers and local wholesalers, anywhere that was within driving distance, and driving distance meant at least 4 hours a day. So I went to a lot of these places, Kansas City, St. Louis, Chicago, and Minneapolis, or almost Minneapolis. And there were a lot of book wholesalers there, and there were a lot of, in those days, they had Barnes & Noble, and there was another chain that went out of business, but I can't remember where they are right now. But they had what were called regional buyers. So I found out who they were and decided I was going to go visit them, taking my manuscript, of course, and now trimmed down to look like it was book size and edited down. And I showed them my book, and you know, let them know how enthusiastic I was, and that, of course, I was planning to do book signings in their stores once it was released. And I'm quite sure that it was enthusiasm that infected them. I'm certain of that now. And they decided, okay, we'll take a risk on this guy. And they wrote up orders for me, pre-orders for the book on their stationery, or gave me, you know, purchase order numbers. And I had collected 2,400 pre-orders for this book, which is a pretty substantial amount, I thought, and I took my little package of stationery and POs and everything, went back to the bank and showed it to the same loan officer, who then smacked himself on the forehead and said, I'm going to regret this. But he ended up writing me a loan for $14,000, and he didn't regret it. As it turned out, I fulfilled my obligations to these bookstore chains, and as a result of some good luck and a lot of audacity, I ended up pushing the book onto. The way it really happened was I got a great review. I actually sent a book well after the fact to Publishers Weekly, who liked it, wrote me a great review. That review suddenly appeared everywhere. It was just suddenly, I couldn't believe it. Everybody and their brother had picked up this review, and then the book was selling, and I had a whole new set of problems, and that was, how do I keep up with the sales? And now I have to continue to reprint, and how many do I reprint, and how do I get them shipped?
And were you, fulfilling the orders yourself?
I was doing it all myself. I'd literally become a one-book publishing company, and that's how I learned how to publish. So that tells the story of the old days and what it used to be like to publish. You had to have warehousing and shipping and collections and all. It just goes
but
on.
You were
and
still
on.
Printing it out on your word processor, and then.
Oh no! Mm-hmm. Au contraire, at this point, I had actually taken the book to press. That's what I was getting loan from the bank for.
Oh, sure.
So I had it properly typeset. In those days, they were still printing negatives to produce press plates. Which, you burn a press plate, and then you put it on the rollers and all that.
That's why it was so expensive.
Yeah, and that's also why you can't print a book one at a time. You have to print them
thousands
at a time.
Was the minimum order quantity 5,000, something like that?
No, you can actually print as few as 2,000, which is a sensible way to begin if you're going to go that route, because that's where the price breaks begin.
Okay.
But I needed more copies than that to start out with. So
now when a bookstore orders your book and puts it on the shelf, if it doesn't sell, what happens?
They'll send it back to the publisher eventually. The publisher is always sort of the low man on the totem pole, or so it used to be. The new route that we're taking, we're forcing retailers to completely change their buying style. When I was out doing book signings to push Everyday Miracle Happens, up the bestseller ladder, I'd go to bookstores, and I was always very flattered to see this. And they'd have a whole bunch of books sitting in pyramid-shaped things, or they'd have them all set out with all the covers showing, and I thought, oh, this is really flattering. But the downside is they don't really care about those books. You'll go there, and it brings in an audience when they see a big pyramid of books, and you'll sign your books, and all goes well. But if they've ordered, 70 or 80 or 100 copies of your book, and you only sell 20 of them, they'll sit on the remaining, whatever they have left, 40, 50, 60 copies of them. If they don't sell after the next month or two, because people always dribble in later, then they'll send it back to the publisher, and the publisher then has to pay the bookstore the amount for the books that they returned, if those books were paid for in the first place.
Mm.
So that it's a little tricky.
Yeah.
But returns has always been the scourge of the industry, and the way that we're publishing now, we're saying, no, you can't buy our books on a return basis. You have to, you buy them as many as you need, and that's it. So we're literally forcing them to change their habits, and there's not much they can do about it. If your books are selling and consumers are coming into the bookstores looking for them, they're either losing a sale or, that's about it.
Right.
They're losing a sale, so they don't want to do that. They don't want to disappoint a customer. They want to make sure they have the book there when the customer gets there.
Now that works. I can see where it works really well for Amazon, because they don't have to warehouse. They don't have to have the book there in the store in a store.
Right.
But for a retailer, how do they know how many to order? How do they tell what their need is?
Well, that's the trick, really. The way the industry is working now, you really don't need to have a lot of books on a bookshelf. You can even have one or two. You don't have to go out and order 30. There was for a short period of time, there was a wonderful concept as far as ecology goes in the whole retail bookstore chain. And there was a company called Peanut Press, which unfortunately has now gone out of business. They formed an alliance with Borders Books, and they set up a number of bookstores that had only one copy of the book in the store. And they had the kind of press presses that I just described you, these print-on-demand presses, with the digital files loaded into them via satellite for the most part. So if a customer came in and said, can I have a copy of this book, then
they'd print it right
the clerk
on
would
the
say, sure, and then they would just key it in, you know, the ISBN number right into the cash register, and by the time they hit return and take your money and all the rest, it's already printing in the back room. So they literally, okay, here's your book, you know.
Now, is that going to grow? Is that going to be the way most books are distributed?
I think, well,
kind of print on site?
I think it might be. There's a lot going on in that world right now that most of us don't know that much about. There are, in third world, many of these third world countries seem more advanced than us. You know, I have a comment about that. But nonetheless, in third world countries, they're doing things like this because they have to. They just don't have the resources to print huge quantities of books and just distribute them randomly. And it's just a smarter way to go anyway. And they have these book mobiles that literally go from school to school or library to library. And mm-hmm. if people want books, they can just print them for you right there on the spot. They've got the print-on-demand presses in the back of the van.
Wow.
With a satellite on top of the van. So people come in and they can pay their small amount of money for whatever the book that they might want, and in many cases they're our own books. They're, you know, First World Library books, and these things can actually download the content, print it right there on the spot, and hand it to the people
now,
who have ordered them.
First World Library get compensation in a situation like that for the use of your print files?
If it's in some cases, yes. In this particular case, the answer would be no, because we're making our books also available as free ebooks.
Right.
So any sensible person would be downloading the free book rather than the one that they would have to pay for. But as an odd turn of events, even though we've made these books available for free, there are large companies buying the ebooks, which really doesn't make any sense at all. But they do, and they buy them for $1.99 for every ebook, and then they resell them to consumers for, you know, whatever, a dollar or two more.
Well, why are they buying them if they're free?
Good question. Good question. I'm not at a point where I want to, you know, tell them, hey, don't buy our books, because, you know, the more revenue you have, the more books
right.
that we can produce.
Right.
But they're in the business of selling books, and that's what they do. You know, Amazon is a good customer of ours, in fact, and they'll actually do that. They'll purchase e-books, turn them around, and sell them to their own customers.
As e-books.
And they'll mark them up, yeah, as e-books.
As e-books.
And they'll mark them up in the process. So they're making money as the middleman.
Now, an e-book means that it stays in digital format, that it's showing up on a screen somewhere, not on paper.
Correct.
Okay. And I know that there have been a variety of gadgets of like little, like a CD player, but it's an ebook player and have those taken off at all? Do you see a future for that?
Well, about 10 years ago, before the dot-com crash, the whole ebook thing was thought to be huge, and everybody, all publishers were moving in that direction, get your books ready for ebooks, and there were, I think, three major formats that we could have gone into at that point, you know, Adobe Glassbook, and I think the Microsoft Reader was the other one, and I've forgotten what the third one is already. You're wondering what that squeaky sound?
Yeah.
Yeah, me too. I have no idea. Oh, it's a cricket. We have a cricket who wants to be interviewed.
Oh!
In any case, the whole ebook hardware became a monumental failure. People spent billions of dollars trying to develop ebooks, and Barnes & Noble came out with their ultimate failure, which was the Rocket Book. You know, the most cumbersome, ridiculous type of ebook reader that you could get, and then it just simply didn't take off. You know, people are not comfortable reading on the digital platforms at this point. It seems to me people are more comfortable doing research oriented reading on
right.
computer screens
mm-hmm.
and, you know, on whatever cell phones, I suppose, at this point. But not comfortably reading a book, and I, for that reason, I don't think it's ever going to go away. It's ubiquitous. Most people
yeah.
do not feel warm and fuzzy with a computer.
You're not relaxed,
right?
When you're sitting looking at a screen, it's not the same feeling sitting in a chair
right.
with a lamp and your feet up and you're reading this book.
Yeah, or reading anywhere, you know, on the beach. And yeah. You know, I mean, you contort yourself when you're reading, and you know, everybody's got their thing that they like to do. And you know, you can't do that with a computer.
Right.
Even if you had something that was shaped like a book, that's a piece of hardware, it's still not, it's harder on the eyes, for one thing, I think.
Yeah, well, I think that's why most of the young kids are wearing glasses. I'm pretty sure that's why I am.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I think it is. Computer screens definitely are hard on the eyes. I look at a computer screen 8 hours a day, you know, bright light looking at me, mm-hmm. 8 hours a day. Well, here's another story, kind of off topic, but certainly interesting. When I was looking at e-books many years ago, you know, going to the conventions to see what was coming out, because, you know, you have to know these things, there were a couple of things that were so interesting, and I can't believe that at least one of them didn't catch on. But one was what was like magic to me at the time. It was called e-paper. I think it still is, e-paper. And it has its application at this point, and I've seen it in use in bulletin boards and whatnot. But there was someone at the New York Book Convention that had all these e-paper books. And what it was a book like any other book, looked exactly like this one in front of us. And inside, it was a hardcover book, and inside the spine, you could open the book, and it would be, you know, George Orwell's 1984. And it was, if you wanted to read another book, you would just press a button on the spine, and okay, now here's the magic. And the ink would magically dance on the pages and form new letters, okay, words, sentences, and pages. Now, I'm not kidding. And the way it worked is that the paper was electrostatically charged, and the ink had microscopic quantities of iron ferrite in the ink.
Oh, my gosh.
And that's how it worked. It was literally magic.
That is,
and
like,
this, it's still in use. At the time, they were saying, oh, this is going to be the new newspapers of the world and all the rest, because they're recyclable for the most part. You know, you just buy one newspaper, and then every day they just download the day's news into your newspaper. It never happened because it's just too expensive and impractical at this point. But it is in use on bulletin boards. There are bulletin boards out there that now have been papered with this stuff, probably laminated somehow to make it weatherproof. But they can just send a signal to the board, you know, sitting at a computer screen, and just change the advertisement, you know, from from K. Rue to David Lynch's advertisement, anything they want.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, that sounds
That sounds like something from outer space. It just doesn't
sound
like it.
It really does, doesn't it? And there were other things that were more practical than e-paper, and it was a little expensive and all that. But the Microsoft came out with its reader, which I actually thought was quite good too, where you could, it was like one of these
tablet kind of thing.
Yeah, tablet style. It was very small. You could fit it in your pocket, and you could turn it on, and they created a screen that was much easier to read than most other screens. And the feature that I particularly liked is, if you didn't want to read any longer, you could just press a button and it would read itself to you. And they had a selection.
That sounds neat.
They had a selection of voices that were pretty good, and it was still a little metallic. You know, didn't quite get to the point where that's a nice reader. But I think in time they probably could have.
Mm-hmm.
So I was rather satisfied with that, and I thought, hey, that's great. You know, anywhere I am, I just turn it on, I could start listening to a book.
Wow, and you can download different books into it. And
of course, yeah. Wow. Well, now that's popular anyway. Everybody's got their MP3 player, and you can listen to any book you want.
So. Right, right. But this way you could read it if you want, or listen to
it. Right, 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 right. Well, there was more to it than that. If you were an editor, you could get in there and edit. They had a little wand and the whole bit. You just touch it, and you get in there, and a window opens, and you write your editorial comments. You know, this needs to be changed. You know, the writer's voice really sucks here, and whatever it was you wanted to say.
Now, was the recording, or the voice, was it a digital recording, or was it a kind of computerized voice that was reading at that time?
It was a computerized voice that would recognize the words and read it to you. So it was stiff, a little bit stiff, but not too bad. I mean, I was a little surprised they'd come that far.
Wow.
I know. It's just hard to believe.
Well, the e-paper reminds me of something I just saw this morning. It's a kind of paper that you can do to print pictures, like photos, except you're not printing. The ink is in the paper, so you don't need a printer. So they have a digital camera coming out that will, it's kind of like an old Polaroid kind of thing, where it just comes right out of the camera.
Mm-hmm.
and it's because the ink is built into the paper and it heats up and so forth and releases in a certain way. Now, it's not recyclable like the e-paper, but it seems like a similar type of technology, and that's going to be available by Christmas, I think.
Wow. Well, I haven't heard of that one.
Okay, do you think if we have all these things like books that we'll read to, do you think that people will not learn to read then? I mean, you know, just the other day I sat down to read and I thanked God that I could read because I love to read. And I was really grateful that I could. And I'm just, having been a former teacher, I know that children who can't read, have no interest in reading, they're handicapped. But maybe not now as much as they used to be. But they'd say, "Well, I don't have to learn to read because of the computer." And I said, "But you got to read the screen, you know." So that's not really a good excuse. But I'm just curious.
Well, computer content is moving more and more towards video and sound, audio than it was. I mean, the last couple of years, there's been a huge move from that. But it's still 99% words on the screen.
Well, to date, and you know, these are sort of the book industry facts. To date, you remember when the internet, and the internet's still so new, it's almost bizarre, isn't it? We can't live without it now. But when it was all still even newer, there was a fear that people are going to be reading less as a result of the internet, and I'm not entirely sure what the logic for that was, but that was the fear. And, of course, publishers were thinking, oh, I'm going to be selling less books because now the Internet, everybody can get what they need on the Internet. They don't need us any longer. It went the other direction. Book sales have increased since the advent of the Internet, significantly increased, I might add. So at very least, more books are selling. Whether they're being read or not is questionable. there's so many people who say most books that get purchased, only the first 30 pages get read, and that's it. And that probably is the case in the United States, but I don't think reading habits are like that in other countries. But nonetheless, it seems that the Internet has caused us to read more. We're actually reading more today than we ever have.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
So what do you see as the role for a publisher now? Because with the print on demand, anyone can go in and set that up for themselves using the print on demand company. Mm-hmm. What is the role of the publisher now?
I think the role of the publisher is service-based at this point, and I'm seeing it happening. There was a big shakeup in the publishing industry a short while ago. About 8 years ago, in fact, and I'll tell you a little story about that because it's a little odd, really. I think it was 8 years ago, and please don't quote me on time, as I'm terrible that way. I can't even remember how old I am most of the time. But about 8 years ago, a huge overseas conglomerate, a German company, commonly understood to be Bertelsmann's, which I think most people associate with Napster and all that. But they purchased Barnes & Noble, a huge company, because Barnes & Noble has interest in everything. They own Target, and they own all these other big, big companies. Well, they purchased them, and through the agency of Barnes & Noble, bought Ingram Books, Ingram Book Distributors, which is the biggest distributor in the world. They say that 80% of all books flows through Ingram. When they bought Ingram, they decided they were going to put everything that wasn't a Barnes & Noble interest out of business. So they determined that they were no longer going to ship any books to independent bookstores.
Whoa.
And they started acquiring a lot of small chains. I think they already owned Books a Million and many of the other companies associated with Barnes & Noble, and acquired as many as they could. But anything they couldn't buy, they decided they were going to aggressively put out of business. So the flags went up, and various people joined camps. Amazon joined together with Borders to try to stay alive, and then a lot of the independents were all there supporting them, and the lawsuits were flying. And the Supreme Court eventually ruled that this was, in fact, a monopoly and antitrust, and therefore reversed the sale. So John Ingram took a possession of his old company again, Ingram Books, and Barnes & Noble was obviously very angry and found a way around having to pay out any of the damages done by saying, well, it was actually our .com that started that. So they made the purchase, not Barnes & Noble brick and mortar, so they didn't have to pay out anything, which, of course, was a lot of baloney. They, in retaliation, they then purchased every major publishing company in the United States and Canada, including one of the biggest ones, what's the name of it? Random House, which is about a collection of about 120 houses, publishing houses, you know, big houses, Macmillan and Macmillan, Ballantine, and all the names everybody's heard.
Wow.
So they own all that at this point. They now own the production side, and they'd already owned other big ones like Bantam Books and all that. But they now own the retail side and the production side, with the exception of, you know, the Amazons and the Borders. The good news is they didn't change the way these people operate. They're completely autonomous, and they didn't even touch them. So that was good. Everybody was surprised, and we're all glad. Nonetheless, there's still a lot of power in the balance here. They have the retail side of it, and they own the production side of it. They just don't own the distribution ship. And everybody remembers this part of it. Barnes & Noble merged with America Online through the agency of America Online, the biggest business buyout in the history of business, $160 billion, Time Warner Industries.
Right.
Which, of course, is practically every newspaper in the United States, almost right. Every movie house in the United States. Huge amount of power owned by some conglomerate somewhere. Now, I was leading into a story about the future of publishing, right?
Right.
Well, the future of publishing, and this is where the story is all going. The future, I didn't know I had these stories until you asked me this question. So I apologize in advance, but I'm just rambling on. You got me excited.
It's extremely interesting.
The future of publishing is very service-oriented. You see this happening in almost every other industry where you can practically build your own everything. You go to Lowe's or Home Depot or whatever they are, not intending to advertise for anybody, but you go to these places and you can buy everything. If you assemble it yourself, it's very cheap, and you can assemble it yourself and put it up in your own house. You can even build your own house. They have kits to build your own houses these days. You know, you call them up and say, bring one to this location, and they lay a foundation, and you build your own house. So it's becoming affordable, and it's moving in that direction because it works for the consumer and it works for the supplier, and the middlemen are getting cut out. And that's one of the things that the Internet has really created, too, you know, direct from, you know, a producer to consumer.
Right.
So publishing is going the same way. In the old days, you had to have agents, and you had to pay your agent a monthly fee to run your book around town, to show it to the big publishing houses, and can you get it sold? It was expensive and time-consuming, and if you were lucky, you got a hit. And then if you did get a hit, you had to give up your copyright to the publishing house, and you usually ended up with, at best, somewhere between 2 and 5% of royalty. That'd be the best that you could possibly get, unless, of course, you're Stephen King or somebody. And that was the old method of publishing. Now, going the new route, this whole POD has allowed everybody else to play on the same playing field. Now, you can play with the big boys. You can have your book available in Barnes & Noble, Amazon, Borders, and all the major .coms, and around the world, actually, and have never spent more than a small amount of money, the startup cost, depending on how much you want to do yourself. You can get your own book published and play out there with the big boys. And to prove this point, I forget how long ago it was, but Stephen King decided to try it. He stepped away from his traditional publisher, Simon & Schuster, and said, well, let's just see if I can do it on my own. Well, someone with that big a name doesn't have any trouble selling books. So he did. He published one-third of, I think it was Riding the Bullet, if I remember correctly, published one-third of it. Hadn't even finished it yet. He just rewrote the first third, published it. Amassed, I think, somewhere in the neighborhood of 1 million orders, maybe just under 1 million orders. Wrote the second half of it, got another 1 million-plus orders. Wrote the third half of it with multiple endings, you know, pick and choose your own ending. And you can, with Pick on Demand, you can do that, you see, because you can actually have the same book and then have optional endings that will all go into the same book on one printer. It's kind of neat. You can update a book any time, you know, on a print-on-demand system, something you can't do once a book is already
in. Now, are you saying that all the optional endings show up in the same book, or
if you bought
book
them,
only has
if you
one?
Bought them, they would. But you have an option to choose, you know, the happy ending, the sad ending, or, you know, the horrifying ending in the case of Stephen King.
Oh, my goodness.
So anyway, he proved that it can be done successfully and relatively easily, and no one knows the outcome of it. To this date, but Simon & Schuster obviously made him an offer he couldn't possibly refuse. So probably they offered him something like, you know, we'll split the entire revenue with you to get you back.
Yeah.
Because clearly they were losing money by not having him around. But those are the new days of publishing. But you can do it yourself now, and you don't need to waste time and energy looking for agents or getting rejection letters. And frankly, you're better off that way, in my opinion. And
this but for is, the average do-it-yourself author, mm-hmm. getting it published by print on demand is one thing. Getting it into a bookstore is something else completely different.
Well, thus the whole company. We have the whole First World Publishing is specifically designed as an author services company.
Okay.
That's entirely what it is.
Okay.
So we've done well with it. We've had bestsellers in there, so there's no one who can ever argue with us that say, oh, print on demand doesn't work. No one's going to take you seriously. Well, they obviously took a bestseller seriously, so that
right.
everything else is myth. It just whatever fears you have, they don't exist.
So now, which company is this?
We have another company here in town called First World Publishing.
First World Publishing, yeah. And it's author services. Now, do you take all comers, or are you selective about who you're going to help with this?
We like to be a little bit picky. We don't want to be recognized as someone who just publishes trash. So we won't publish a book if it is trash. If you bring us a book, we'll look it over and we'll say, you know, this book has potential, but it needs a serious edit, in some cases a total rewrite, whatever the case may be. And in some cases, the authors listen to us, and they'll rewrite the books themselves, and then they'll one nice thing about Fairfield is there's plenty of good writers and editors here, so we've got a nice base of editors that we keep employed. And then we bring the work in, the editors do the work, we now have a polished, satisfactory product, we can get it. You know, we're proud to publish it, the authors are proud prouder of their own book than they would have when it first, you know, came on our desk, and then we can send it out.
Okay, in the case of children's books, do you have an illustrator? You have illustrators that
sure,
are available?
Sure, we the same thing. Fairfield's rich in illustrators, so we use a lot of the locals here to make sure that we can keep business in town.
Now, your son has written and published.
Well, we have a glint in your eye when I said that. Are you an illustrator? Or?
No, I'm not, but my daughter has written a really neat book. Children's book, The Bottom Plate.
Oh, she should come and talk to you for sure.
Yeah, she should,
because
it's a great story.
We're almost out of time, and I want to give you time to read from your book. We haven't at all talked to you about your life as a writer. And
this is so interesting.
And we also really could, I think, spend a whole other program just on the author services and how you help.
Yeah,
and
we could.
Be glad to.
I would really like to have you back, and your son, who has written and published two children's books titled Dad and Me Go to School and Planets. And he is, how old is he?
He's 8 years old.
8 years old, so we're going to have him.
And generating a royalty.
Too.
So he's putting pressure on Dad. You know?
sounds like he has a great future ahead.
So, Rodney, what would you like to read to us today? I think you've got the book over there.
I'm going to get the big glasses on here, and I'm going to qualify this a little. It's something I tell my authors never to do. But this was a book that was written, I think, almost 14 years ago. So every writer who's ever written knows that he's grown out of his work after 14 years. So I sort of feel like I've grown significantly distant from this, but I look back at it and I think, did I really write that? You know, and parts of it I really like, and parts of it I go, wow, I really, really was a little anal, wasn't I? Okay, I'll read from this. This is a book that I spoke about earlier, Everyday Miracle Happens. It ended up being a religious bestseller for me, and that's who I was at the time when I wrote it. So this one is a particular story dedicated to September 2nd, and there's a story for every day of the year in this book. It's called From Pillar to Post. It reads, in all the biographies of saints, it seemed doubtful that there ever lived a character more awesome than Saint Simeon Stylites. His way of life provided a spectacle which was at once challenging, repulsive, and divine. At an early age, his search for solitude led him to develop a hermetic life which, due to its severity, was surely meant for only a few in this world. He was the first and most famous of the pillar hermits, hermits who spent their lives in almost continual prayer, living atop 60-foot pillars in the remotest deserts or abandoned regions. Simeon lived the ideal of human hermeticism, and in his sanctity was well known. He was the object of pilgrimage and veneration from people of all countries and faiths. Emperors, kings, princes, and social leaders of every background swarmed to him for counsel on matters of social administration. Paupers and prostitutes, Jews, Christians, Muslims, Hindus, all races, all religions, all creeds found a common ground of understanding and freedom in Simeon's words of wisdom. His way of life suited his true nature. When he started his reclusion, he chose to live on a 9-foot pillar, which he never left for 4 years. His second home was an 18-foot pillar, where he remained for 3 years, and later a 30-foot pillar for 10 years. His final home, built by his admirers, rose 6 stories above the ground with a platform only 6 feet wide, barely enough room to lie down. There he remained satisfied with a life of continual prayer for 20 years. So holy was this man that not a single person who saw him thought otherwise. When he gave up his pure soul to God, he was fixed in meditative prayer. A maggot from a sore of his body fell from his pillar to the ground, landing near the foot of Basilicus, king of Saracens. With reverence, the king lifted the maggot in his hand and placed it on his eye. A moment later, it was transformed into a pearl. So large and so beautiful and of such fine water that Basilicus valued it more than his entire empire. And this story was, and there's the footnote at the end of the story. The story of Saint Simeon died on September 2nd, A.D. 495. He was one of the desert fathers. The tradition of pillar hermits was continued by Saint Daniel of Constantinople and another Saint Simeon of Antioch, which is where he originally was from. The undisturbed authenticity of the acts of Saint Simeon are recorded in the Vatican, the church history, by the historian Theodore.
Wow.
So this book has 365 such stories, most of which I got from Vatican Library sources.
So how long did it take you to write that book? You said you were working, you know, had a day job while you were writing that. How long did that take?
It actually took years because my day job took me to other countries as well.
Wow.
So it took a long time and a lot of rather antiquated computers.
And what kept you going? What kept you motivated to finish it?
You know, that's the question you should ask every author. What makes them write? Yeah, I was just in fascination of saints. You know, I guess I always wanted to be one, so might as well read about them.
And write about them. Wow. And is that book still selling?
Still is. Still earns an income for me, and I'm happy about that.
And have you converted to print on demand for that, or do you still have
the copies in the garage
somewhere?
Well, actually, I do still have copies in the garage somewhere, but it's been through so many editions. This edition was specifically built for Books Are Fun, who picked it up many, many years ago. So there's a lot of different, you know, editions of this book, and I'm actually rewriting it as we speak. Redoing it as we speak to re-release it as a new edition. It's something, you know, writers should do from time to time with their works, re-release them because it gives them a new breath, and you know, you generate another stream of revenue as a result.
Right. Yeah, might as well.
Yeah.
So what's your next, I mean, you seem to be really quite the one for starting businesses and starting projects. Do you have something else on the horizon, or are you pretty got your hands full with what you've got now?
Got my hands full, but still starting new things. We have something that I've been wanting to bring out for years. It just seems like it always works that way. I have an idea, and before it actually becomes anything, it's 3 or 4 years later. The non-for-profit and all the classic books is working quite well now, and the author services company is working very, very well now. We have a number of programs that I'd really like to get going, and I wish this program would reach across the entire U.S. so I could say these things, but we're inviting teachers, particularly literature teachers on any level, you know, elementary, middle school, or high school, university, to come and start some of the programs like the books that I've shown you here where we we have these grants and people can write poetry and we put them in books and we like to go into the schools and sort of generate the whole concept of poetry, because the idea is that the one thing that seems to be missing from the public school system, at least, is finding your own voice, finding your own opinions. And a lot of children are very bold these days. If you have kids, you know what I mean. But they don't have their own voice. And I mean, there's no reason to have strong opinions that are somebody else's. The only thing you're an expert on is yourself anyway. So ultimately, if you're going to have a strong opinion, let it be your own. So writing is a great way to figure that all out. It's a great technique,
absolutely,
and tool for understanding yourself and finding out what your voice is all about. So I'd love to just travel across the country and go from school to school, state to state, and do this little lecture where get people writing and doing poetry and get them published, because it's a learning process. Now once you're published, you can go on radio shows like this and talk about your read from your poetry.
That's right.
And then what you're really doing is you're just telling them about yourself. So it becomes a real growing process. So that would be number one. And then the other is, I've had this concept for a magazine called Unoa, which is the shortest word in the English language that uses all the vowels. It's E, I'm such a good speller, E-U-N-O-I-A, Unoa, and it means beautiful thinking. So we wanted to start Unoa magazine as a literary magazine and get, again, just, this gives us some tool to work with authors and writers to get their stuff out.
Well, Rodney, thanks so much for joining us, and I hope you'll come back. We'll schedule another interview with you and your son.
Be glad to.
This is very informative and very entertaining.
Yeah, I'll say.
And please stay tuned if you're listening on Friday to Planet Erstwhile with James Moore coming up next. And if you're listening Monday morning, please stay tuned for the wonderful Colt Show with Stephen Colt. And we will close today with a quote from Mom.
Kindness is a language which the deaf can hear and the blind can see.
Writer's Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, and Shemaine Montana. Archives available at KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com. Writer's Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.